supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
From WHYY and First Person Arts in Philadelphia, this is Common Space, where live stories connect us to each other and the world. I'm your host, Jamie J., and I'll take you deeper into the stories with conversations that just might challenge your perceptions. So, let's talk about sex, baby. Remember the salt and pepper song? Let's talk about sex, baby. Let's talk about you and me. That makes me think of something else having to do with sex. Have you ever wondered how a middle-aged woman with a heavy accent could become so popular on TV?
Kick boredom out of your bedroom. Don't worry about being normal. Don't worry that you are not exactly like your neighbor.
It's probably because Dr. Ruth Westheimer spoke openly and vividly about all things having to do with sex. Her less inhibited European approach to sexuality gave her authority and credibility. You want to talk about orgasms? Yes, she seemed to say, of course. Condoms, erections, yes, yes, yes!
Have good sex!
Back then, regular people just didn't talk about such things. But now Dr. Ruth has been replaced by even more daring sex therapists using blogs and podcasts. And in our complicated world, the need to talk about sex has only increased. And that talk is all over the place.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to another episode of Guys We've...
It's the Anti-Slut-Shaming Podcast.
Hello and welcome to Sex Lives, the New York Magazine sex podcast.
Thanks for listening to the Dr. Drew Podcast.
I'm Nikki Glaser. Welcome to Not Safe. Tonight we're going to talk about sex because, look, I'm doing it, you're doing it.
Well, there's nothing you can't ask on the Savage Podcast.
By the way, we are talking about sex here, so it's obviously not material for all ages. Of course, we all know from the news these days that there's a really ugly side of sex. Non-consensual sex having to do with horrendous abuse, exploitation, violence, and misconduct. But those stories belong in another show at another time. Today, we wanted to tell sex-positive stories about love, discovery, gender, chance encounters, and more. And we add to it a dynamite conversation with comedian Margaret Cho.
When I was a kid in school, being so different as I am, it was very hard to kind of relate to other kids because I felt like, well, my world is so much bigger than this.
Everyone has a sex story. They can be clueless and funny or emotionally powerful and complicated. Naturally, we start off at the beginning, that clunky, sometimes awkward moment of the first sexual encounter. I remember mine. I decided at 17 years old that I was ready to take the plunge. The fact that I didn't have a boyfriend made no difference whatsoever. So I simply selected the nicest guy I met and took the plunge. It was a terrible experience, and I don't recommend it for anyone. Anyway, here's writer Diane Ivey.
To celebrate my last night in Michigan, I decided to lose my virginity. I was moving the next day to Springfield, Illinois from Lansing, Michigan for graduate school. And the summer after I graduated from college from Michigan State, I was dating this guy, and his name was Jay. And Jay was a really good friend of my roommate's, and he was kind of chubby and quiet, and one time he canceled the date because his Dungeons & Dragons game ran 3 hours over schedule. But he found me completely and totally fascinating, which, as far as I'm concerned, is the most important quality a man can have. So I decided that morning of my last day in Michigan that Jay and I were going to finally have sex. And I thought it would be this big last hurrah for me. It would be this sweeping romantic experience. And I thought maybe it would be like the scene between Karen Allen and Harrison Ford in Raiders of the Lost Ark. Because I think the reason that I was still a virgin at 22 was that I was still saving myself for Harrison Ford. And I thought that maybe Jay would get injured and I'd have to kiss it and make it better. And right before we made love, I would sweep off his fedora, because he's wearing a fedora in this fantasy. And we would make love all night. And then the next day, we would, you know, go out facing the uncertain future together. So my last night in Michigan, I'm at Jay's house, and we're outside. And he says, "So what do you want to do tonight?" And I say, "I think you know what I want to do tonight." And we go into his bedroom. I've actually never been in his room before. He lives in one of those college houses that has three sombreros but no kitchen table. And he has this bed that's just like got a fitted sheet and a fleece zebra print blanket. And every geeky 20-something-year-old guy, if you date those kind of dudes, they always have this elaborate home-built computer, you know, situation like Matrix, like three monitors. One always has some anime girl half naked. You're like, is this To Catch a Predator? Is that legal? Is that okay? So we're in his room and we start to kiss and I'm like, all right, I'm going to be swept away by the passion. I don't care about the house. That's not important. We'll be lost in the ocean of each other. And things are going pretty well. I'm feeling it. And then he takes off my bra. And he's staring at me, topless, and he says, "Your boobs are really symmetrical." And I say the only thing I can think of, which is, "Thank you." And I move to take his shirt off, and as I lift it over his head, I realize that he has a lot of back hair. And I don't know what to do with this. I don't know if you're supposed to touch it or not touch it. I'm like, do I kind of just ignore that? And like, he's much taller than me, so like, I don't really have another place to like put my hands, you know? So I'm like, do I run my fingers through? What do I do? I really don't know. And he finally like sees me kind of like, what? And he says, "Yeah, I know I have a lot of back hair." And I said, the only thing I could think of, which was, "Have you tried shaving it?" And I finally, we get to the point, and I, you know, put my hand over, you know, his penis, and I'm like trying to figure out what to do now, because I have never seen a real live penis, and I feel like I should savor this moment, but at the same time, I'm terrified of what will happen next. And so I kind of take it out from like beneath the sweatpants, like you do, and I'm faced with this just total frozen, what? And I mean, I've seen a lot of porn, like a lot of porn, but I always skip the blowjob because it just takes too damn long. And I'm like, are we still doing this? And then you check and refresh, like maybe my video is stuck. Like, why is this still happening? So I have no idea what to do next. I've always avoided phallic objects lest I give someone, you know, a boner accidentally. So I just have no idea. And finally, I look at him like, what do I do? And I think I said, what do I do with it? And he says, pull it. And I think of like that children's toy, the bop it, you know, like bop it, twist it, pull it. I forget the fourth one. Isn't there a fourth one? Maybe not. And that's all I can think of. And I'm like bop it? So I start and I feel him flinch. And he looks at me and he says, I think we should cuddle now. And we just lay there listening to his roommates play video games in the basement. And I can feel my romantic dreams and my epic last-ditch romance just disappearing beneath the zebra print fleece blanket. And I finally leave and I go home because I have to finish packing for this move. And the next day I wake up and I drive home, or I drive to Illinois, my new home, with my mother in the car. It's nothing like 7 hours in the car with your mom after you first touched a penis Literally all I could think of was like, I touched a penis last night. Does she know? Like, can she tell? Is it on my hands now, like an imprint? Like, touched a dick, everybody. Touched a dick last night. Like 4 hours ago, and now we're in the car listening to probably NPR, and I'm like, it's really inspirational. Like, no, it's not. And I moved to Illinois, and I realized quickly that I'm not the kind of girl that can hit it and quit it, even within a romantic way. It's just not in me. And it took me 2 more years before I could bop, pull, or twist a penis again. Thank you.
Diane Ivey is a writer and storyteller, currently living in Washington, D.C. Let me tell you, for all the talk about how things have changed, for young people, half of the struggle to express their new love remains finding a private place and time for a couple to be together. But for our next storyteller, Chris Lundy, actually getting privacy with a very special overnight guest turned out to be the surprisingly but only easy part.
It was the blizzard of 96, right? And I was in high school. I had a girlfriend at the time. Her name was Daia. I know, Daia. And she was my high school sweetheart. And I had a scheme to get snowed in with Daia, right? So I got her dropped off to my house, or, you know, I was staying with my mom, of course. And I got her dropped off. So we're chilling, and my mother comes home from work, and she's like, hey, you know, a really big snowstorm is coming. I'm like, snowstorm? What? That's crazy. And so, you know, we're relaxing. And my mother, she was really liberal about, you know, me having company. That was all good. But spending the night was out of the question. I'm Haitian. My family's Haitian, old-fashioned that way. And so she's like, listen, you know, before the snow gets too bad, we should really get Daia home. And at the time, my mother's boyfriend, a guy named Albert, was living with us. I hated Albert. He was around when I was younger, when I was a little kid. He used to make us call him Daddy. He wasn't my damn daddy. You know, he used to make us drink cod liver oil. He was, He was allowed to spank us if we were out of line. I hated that guy. But he had come into the room and was like, hey, listen, you know, at this point, we might as well let her stay. And so I'm like, all is forgiven. So the stage was set. Daia was staying over. My girlfriend was sleeping over, and we were going to have sex, right? That's what we were going to do. And so it's getting late, and the house is pretty much, you know, all asleep. And so it was time for me and Daia to have sexy time. But the bed was too loud, and the apartment was small. You know, rooms were too close. The bed was too loud, and so we took it to the floor. You know what I mean? We took it down to the floor. And so we're about to, you know, we're getting it on. Now, here's the thing. My room was really small, and in my room there was a dresser. But because it was so small, I also had a bookshelf, and I actually put the bookshelf on top of the dresser to save space. But I just sat it up there. There was no anchoring. It was just on top of the dresser. You know, who cares? Now, everyone who knew about this furniture situation knew to be careful around the dresser because it could easily fall. But for people who didn't know, for example, Daia, they wouldn't know to be careful around said dresser. So we're getting it on. I mean, we're going to town. It is business time. And inch by inch, the bookshelf starts to shimmy off of the dresser until it comes crashing down on me and Daia. I'm talking, boom, everything's all over the place. It's loud as hell. Not only did it wake up the whole house, but it probably woke up the whole building. So I managed to kind of pull myself out from underneath of the bookshelf, and then I hear my mother's door swing open. Now I got a choice to make. I can either help Daia get from under the bookshelf, or I can jump into the bed and pretend like I was asleep the whole time. Now, before I tell y'all what I decided to do, I need you to understand I had a really close relationship with my mother. She thought the world of me. I was on honor roll. I had like attendance certificates. So as I pulled the blankets over top of me, I looked down at Diane. She was just looking up at me in utter disbelief, like, oh my God, you left me in a lurch. So the door comes swinging open. My mother and Albert come running in. What the hell happened? And I lift up like, what the hell happened? And Diane's like, the bookshelf fell on me, da-da-da-da-da. So we get the bookshelf off of her and everything, and I could tell my mother is about to just go off. But that's when Albert goes, hey, you know what? It's really, really late. Let's all just go back to sleep. And I'm like, thanks, Daddy. Thank you. And so they leave, and me and Daya have the biggest whisper argument in the history. She's like, I can't believe you left me like that. I'm like, I'm sorry. There was no time. And she's like, that was so selfish. That's, you know how embarrassed I am? And I'm like, you don't know what it's like living here. It's a prison. And she's like, you know what? We're never having sex again. I'm like, babe, I'm sorry. She's like, no, that was selfish. I'm like, you know what? She don't even like you like that anyway. She loves me. I have to live here and she loves me. So we argue. And you know what? Don't feel too bad for Daya in that embarrassing moment, because later that school year, she actually cheated on me. That's right. No, it's okay. She cheated on me with a buddy of mine, football teammate. It stuck with me for a while. But I learned a big lesson, okay? And this is an important lesson. Everyone pay attention here. If you ever stack furniture, make sure you anchor that shit to the wall. Thank you.
I can't help but wonder if Daya ever forgave him. What do you think? You can ask Chris Lundy, because he's a published writer and still hosts First Person Art Slams on occasion. I think that coming to understand our own sexuality is one of the inevitable rites of passage for any teen. In his story, Trevor Cassidy found inspiration in his school science class as to how to discover his sexual identity.
So I grew up in Denver in a very gay neighborhood. So gay, like the local supermarket, which the actual name of it is King Supers, everyone called Queen Supers. And I remember walking the dog with my mom, and every once in a while, my dog Riley would like come to us with like a used condom that she would find in the lawn. And my mom would be disgusted and horrified, and I would just be like, I don't really know what's going on. Like, I was a pretty sheltered child, but I was living in a gay world, God damn it. And even extended into Catholic school, although only 8 years, but it was a pretty progressive place. I remember probably one of the best teachers I've ever had in my career as a student was my sixth grade science teacher, aptly named Mr. Blessy of the Catholic school. But he taught evolution and like a modern sort of take on sexual education, and actually was gay himself. But I had two best friends in middle school, Jacob, who's was being raised by his uncle and his uncle's partner because his mom was in a assisted living institution for her schizophrenia, and his dad had run out on him when he was a kid. So I had Jacob, and then my other friend was Roy. And Roy and I had lots of great times together. One special time was a camping trip that I took with him and his family the summer after sixth grade. And we did all the things that you do on a camping trip. We went hiking and swimming and stayed up late in like the kids' tent talking. And on the first night, Roy actually, he confessed to me that he had stolen a pornographic magazine from his dad's stash. And it was just this magazine filled with these like pictures of these very voluptuous black women. And we were sort of like, of course, like thumbing through it by flashlight together. And Roy like kind of stops. He's like transfixed by this one girl, Michaela, I remember. It was a relatively small picture on the right page in the upper left-hand corner. And the way that she was posed, she was just sort of like bending over the hood of like a red convertible. And she was wearing this bright pink thong that sort of dipped down between her thighs. And she was looking over her left shoulder, right at me and Roy. And Roy he just kept going on, oh, man, she's so attractive. And, man, like, I'm so hard right now. And I'm just kind of like, I can't relate to that second part. And it was something that had troubled me because even for the rest of the camping trip, I was thinking, God, Michaela, you are really attractive. And, like, you have a great ass, like, objectively, but, like, I'm not rising to the occasion. And that troubled me all the way home until we were riding by Queen Supers, and suddenly the solution occurred to me. Oh, my God, yes. Like, what if that's it? Like, what if I'm, like... Fortunately, Mr. Blessy was a great teacher, and the thing that he touted around as most special and dear to him was the scientific method. If you leave sixth grade with nothing else, you take the scientific method with you to the grave. So I proposed, I hypothesized to myself, using inspiration from Queen Supers, if not stimulus A and reaction A, then let's try stimulus B and see. I mean, so I put together a little experiment. I was an only child, so I waited for the work week to come when I knew I would rule the roost, so to speak, and my parents would both be away at work. So I scoured our video collection for anything that looked like it could remotely resemble softcore gay pornography. And I finally settled on our copy of Saturday Night Live's The Best of Chris Farley, which, as you know, has that notorious scene, that titillating scene with Patrick Swayze and Chris Farley auditioning for Chippendales. And I was very nervous. I don't know what's going to happen with this, but I queued it up, I turned it on, and it was marvelous. And there it was, right on cue. And I thought, oh, great, like, this is perfect. I can check off that box, like, you know, sexual identity. Like, okay, good. Like, oh, thank God. I've realized, though, in hindsight, that according to the scientific method, you can't prove your own hypothesis. You can only disprove your A hypothesis. So it wasn't that I had sort of realized that I was homosexual, but I had denied my heterosexuality potential. Thank you.
Trevor Cassidy teaches group exercise classes and listens to Nicki Minaj. Right on. This is Common Space, a collaboration between First Person Arts and WHYY. It's been supported by the Pew Center for Arts and Heritage. Listen every Sunday at 8 p.m. or subscribe to us anytime on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher. I'm your host, Jamie J. Today, we're all about sex. And to continue in this narrative vein, we have a story of what often follows self-discovery, self-acknowledgement. For Paul Lyons, it was a journey that took him all the way to Australia. Listen in.
I reconnected with Joan on Facebook. And we had dated 27 years ago when we were 27. And we hit it off this time. So I asked her, I said, whatever happened to us? And she goes, I don't know. Back then my parents, had just died. I was divorced. I had a baby. I was a mess. You know, I said, yeah. I said, I was just divorced and I was a mess too. And I said, well, it's not like I'm not a mess now. You know, I'm just more willing to be seen. You know, and we got along great. And a month into the relationship, my willingness to be seen got tested because Joan, we're on the phone, and matter-of-factly said, I can't believe it. You got seven brothers, and no one's gay. And I said, well, I come the closest. And then I got self-conscious because I felt like I didn't want her to think it was just a joke. And for the next 20 minutes, I just debated what to tell her because it's something in the past that I would wait 6 months to tell a woman after we were in love, you know, just to see if she really loved me. know, and then I'll drop the bomb. This is who I am. And I figured this time I want to go in. I want to be fully seen now. I just, you know, if it's going to work, it's going to work. If it's not, it's not. So I said, Joan, I just want you to know I've had gay experiences. And she said, oh, she goes, you're even more interesting than I thought. And I'm like, well, I was only looking for acceptance, and I was getting accolades, for crying out loud. You know, and because that was my biggest fear my whole life. So much fear not accepting any of my sexuality. I was brought up Catholic. That's part of it. You know, and then just fear. A fear of being gay, looking gay, anyone thinking I might be gay, accidentally, you know, being enthusiastic about something. So... As a matter of fact, when I was 12, my brother Chris, 1 year older than me, says, anyone who masturbates is gay, right? And I did not want to be gay, you know, so I didn't masturbate. I didn't, you know, I didn't touch my penis, you know. I know it's my penis, but I'm a guy, right? You know, what if I meet a guy who looks like me, you know? I don't want to get started. I used it to pee, and I tucked it away. Good job and good night. You know, and then I was 20, and I found out that masturbating is normal. You know, so I became very normal. Very normal. And the normal guy got married, but, you know, just wasn't mature. We weren't mature enough and divorced. And I was 27 years old, and I'm in Sydney, Australia. I'm walking down the street, and I meet this beautiful woman outside her hair salon, Marina. Right? And she goes, hey, where are you going? I said, right here, I guess. Right? And she brings me inside, and we're just she was beautiful. She was voluptuous. And I'm looking at her, and we're cracking each other up. She makes me coffee, and she goes, you're looking at me like you've never seen breasts before. And I said, well, I've never seen yours. I got game. And I say to her, I say, you're looking at me like you've never seen a crotch before, you know? She goes, well, I've never seen yours. You know, I was like, wow, I'm going to get lucky, right? And we kept cracking each other up. She takes me downstairs, right? She whispers in my ear. She goes, I hope you're not an axe murderer, you know? I said, well, I've never used an axe. Right? And then I whisper in her ear, and I'm really hard. Right? And then she whispers in my ear, and she said, me too. And I'm thinking, this is the funniest woman I've ever been with. This woman is hysterical, right? Right? And then we got undressed, right? And I saw her punchline. I couldn't believe it. You know, I was a little, you know, and in situations like that, I ask myself, what would Jesus do? You know? So I took off right after she blew me. I took off, and no, I did take off, and then I felt bad because I was going like, well, I like her, I'm attracted to her, so I went back. 2 days later, I went back, you know, because she was upset when I left the first time because I didn't touch her, you know. I had just beginning to touch myself, you know. So anyway, I left, and anyway, since that experience, I've dated men and women, but I've kept both worlds apart. And coming into the relationship with Joan, I just realized how great it was to just be seen, just who I was. And I feel that you're only as free as the secrets you're willing to reveal. So that's why I'm here, to let you know I'm kind of gay.
Paul Lyons tours the country as a comedian and writer. His first book is called Carpe Diem Mañana, about his spiritual journey from insecurity to self-pity. We can't, in one show, cover the immense universe that is the realm of sexuality. But we can add one more story. This one about sex work. Writer Freya Zork tells her tale of working the telephone sex beat.
When I first started doing phone sex professionally, it was during this kind of weird period in my life when I was still kind of young and wild, but I had gotten myself into this situation where I was being required to stay home and stay out of trouble. The story is that I was working at the time as an egg donor for a fertility clinic, And when I came aboard, they had made me sign this contract for clean living. So, like, no cigarettes, no drugs, no heavy drinking, and absolutely no sex until they got their eggs. But I signed the contract because it was just for a couple months, and they were going to pay me a fortune. And also, I wanted to be an egg donor. Because if you think about it, it's kind of an interesting proposition. I was actually being given the opportunity to impregnate another woman, right? Like, that thought just fills me with this, like, lusty virility. But there I was, stuck at home on my couch, just me and my telephone. So that's when I decided to try and channel all that repressed virility into something a little more productive, right? So before I get to the phone sex, I just want to say that I was an awesome egg donor. They were able to get 40 eggs out of my body in just one retrieval. Thank you. And they were really good eggs. So my potential progeny could take up, like, the first four rows of this audience. Sometimes I like to picture them, like, marching. And even though I'll never know what actually became of any of those eggs, I do think it's pretty likely that there is at least one little person out there somewhere. And I guess she'd be about 9 years old. But anyway, so you guys think I'd make a good phone sex operator? Not really. It's not that I can't be sexy. I think I'm actually kind of good at figuring out what men want and using that to guide them to climax. But that is not actually what makes a good phone sex operator. Uh-uh. If you want to make any money at it, the trick is all about, like, turning them on really slowly and then, like, never quite letting them get there, which was hard for me at first. Like, I just didn't get it. I'd finish up some call that I thought was really hot, and I'd hang up feeling good. But then my boss was always listening in on the line, and she'd be like, "That was 2 minutes 40, Freya. You got to get your head in the game." So I had a lot of satisfied customers, but no, I wasn't making any money. But I do want to tell you about this one call that I thought was really interesting when I finally got a chance to log some real minutes. And I knew this guy was going to be a little different when he told me that he had a passion for community theater. So as I go through this, I just want you guys to picture, like, that it's some long, drawn-out kind of back-and-forth role play, even though I'm just going to give you the gist of it real quick because we're almost out of time. So in this role play, I am a model working at an upscale department store where he is the manager. And when I get back to the wardrobe room, I undress, and the makeup person completely covers my body in this, like, light powder. And then she dresses me again in something chic. And they tell me that my job is going to be to stand up in the window display all day long like a human mannequin. So I get up there and, like, get into position. And I find that it is unusually easy to stay in just, like, the same position all day long. And then it's getting dark in the store, and the store becomes completely empty. And I try to get down out of the window display, but I can't move a muscle. And that's when I realize that the powder that they put all over my body was not makeup at all, but this mysterious chemical that has transformed me into a mannequin. And then I hear his heavy footsteps walking up behind me. So he picks me up and takes me to the back room. And he's, like, stroking my mannequin skin. And it gets into this foreplay, which is kind of passive on my part. But he's into it. And then it escalates into this, like, rough mannequin blowjob. And then he gets there. And, guys, it was awesome. It was, like, so many minutes. And then afterwards, he's done. But, like, he still wants to talk. So he goes, "Nice job. So tell me a little bit about yourself." And I say, "Well, I work as a waitress at a topless bar in the French Quarter." And he says, "Oh, and if I came in, would you wait on me?" And I said, "Sure, baby, you just tell me what you need." And he says, "And what if I started running my fingers up the inside of your leg, up under your skirt?" And now I'm feeling confident, so I want to draw it out even more. So I try teasing him a little bit, and I say, "Uh-uh, can't touch there." But then he says, "That's what you think. But as soon as my fingers touch your wet little panties, you turn straight into a mannequin." Guys, he was really into mannequins. I mean, so interesting. I always wondered what it would be like to be with that guy, for real. He's out there somewhere, too. I wonder if he's ever been able to tell his lover what he really wants. All that fascinating private desire, most of which never gets anywhere past our own imagination or maybe an anonymous phone call. Because even if you're really kinky, there are just some things that you cannot bring to the bedroom. Like, take me for example. I get turned on by artificially inseminating other women. And that is just not practical.
Freya Zork is a nurse practitioner whose work has been featured in multiple podcasts, including Risk, Story League, and of course, WHYY's Common Space. She recently departed Philly for a life in Las Cruces, New Mexico. This is Common Space, a collaboration between First Person Arts and WHYY. It's been supported by the Pew Center for Arts and Heritage. Listen every Sunday at 8 p.m. or subscribe to us anytime on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher. I'm your host, Jamie J. You know, at one point in her career as a renowned comedian, actress, and writer, Margaret Cho remembers working briefly, like Freya Zork, as a phone sex operator. In fact, her sexual history, some of which is tragic and even harrowing, built in her a resilience that feeds her sharp stand-up comedy routines to this day. Being bullied, sexually abused, mocked, and discriminated against for being Asian can do that to a person. It also helped Cho in developing her witty style of social and political critique. I sat with Margaret Cho after her performance at a recent First Person Arts Festival. So welcome to Common Space. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
Well, we are really delighted to have you here. You talk about growing up in San Francisco in this really diverse neighborhood when you were young. Mm-hmm. And yet you were bullied and made to feel like you didn't belong, like you were an outsider. And that intrigues me how that could happen in such a diverse community. Can you tell me about that?
Well, the diversity really kind of is about the adults. When I was with kids, I think by nature are pretty conservative. You know, they sort of want to go with the flow. And if you're different, that can be really hard. But the people that I was growing up around were much older than me. They were people that worked for my father. And my father in the 70s had a gay bookstore. So he had all of these employees who were very political. They were all getting very excited about Harvey Milk. They were going and doing a lot of like rock against Reagan kind of stuff. They were all getting tattoos. And all of that was really incredible to be around. And then when I was a kid in school, being so different as I am, it was very hard to kind of relate to other kids because I felt like, well, my world is so much bigger than this. Whereas the kids in school were really disgusted that Harvey Milk was in office. You know, this like natural tendency for kids to be incredibly homophobic and awful about stuff like that. They were really angry that a gay man, an openly gay man, was in our city government, you know? And so it was like weird to go to school where the kids were just like appalled. And then the people that were working for my dad who were all sort of around me after school at night and everything, they were working for Harvey Milk. So it was very confusing.
Okay.
And so it made me continually seek friends who were older. And then certainly when I started doing comedy, everybody in comedy was significantly older. It's weird to be, I'm the old one now.
No.
Something happened. I don't know where it shifted, but also life in comedy is hard and people don't want to stay in it that long, you know.
Okay.
But I really love it.
So we thrive on stories. So can you tell me the story about when you first did comedy, about the first time?
Well, there was a couple of things. I was doing stuff in school. There was this very flamboyant theater teacher. He was a gay man, and he wore a white suit, and he had roses on his lapel.
Oh,
just
wow.
A very, like a hat. Like, he looked like Quentin Crisp, and he just was incredibly supportive, and you know, we were doing little comedy sets in school. This was when I was really like probably like 14, like a freshman.
Wow.
In high school. And then I started doing comedy with Sam Rockwell, who was my partner. We had like a comedy duo thing where he and I were doing stand-up. And it was weird because we were going to places where like these comedy clubs, which was all adults, and we weren't allowed to be in there because we were both like 14. We weren't allowed to be there unless we were on stage. So we had to sort of wait outside until we got on. And so it was really weird. But I felt that I belonged as a comedian. It just was very apparent that this was my life.
That this was where you belonged.
Yeah.
Yeah. So now I want to shift to something not quite as happy. You know, because we're going chronological.
Mm-hmm.
So you've been really generous in sharing your story about two people that took advantage of you when you were young. One was a family member and one was the boyfriend of a good friend.
Mm-hmm.
And you have not held back in talking about that. And there was something in one of your interviews where you talked about it as a relationship that you had with this friend of the family.
Mm-hmm.
And I really would like to hear you elaborate more on what kind of a relationship was that?
Well, when you're being molested mm-hmm. over a long period of time, it becomes very crazy because you start to really have feelings for your abuser because it's like such a confusing thing. Like, is this right? You know, I don't think this is right, but nobody is telling me that this is wrong. And so it's like you really don't trust your emotions. You don't trust your physical feelings. And that's one of the things that's so disgusting about molestation, sexual abuse, because you're seeing this adult take advantage of a child. And it's so wrong because it messes up your perception for the rest of your life because you're like always questioning like, is this right? Like, I don't think this is right, but I'm like, they're acting like this is right.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's very, I think it's so evil. You know, I think that's one of the things that you can't forgive is somebody who takes advantage of a child like that. But so it happened a couple of times. So in that, when you're kind of in isolation and, you know, an adult is taking advantage of you like that and you're getting very, like, confused, it's really hard to kind of come back to reality and understand that this is wrong. And in Korean culture in particular, I think they really condone the abuse of young people. You know, it's not unusual to see it in families. It's, you know, generations who have been affected by one abuser. Certainly in my life, that one person has wreaked havoc on my family for three different generations of,
wow,
of women. And yet, for some reason, everybody's very complacent around it. And I'm not. Like, I'm not. And I think that's because stand-up comedy is really about expressing your truth. And so it's like the one place where you do feel safe talking about it, I do. Although it is also kind of like people get very triggered. But then I'm so glad because now we've moved past that discomfort. And now we're able to talk about things like Harvey Weinstein.
Right, right.
Or Kevin Spacey.
Right.
Which I am so grateful for all of the people who are coming forward with their stories because it's like when there's one person, there's apt to be many, many more.
Absolutely. And it's funny because when you talk about, you know, this idea of not trusting your feelings, mm-hmm. everything that you just said resonated with me, mm-hmm. even with this idea that the family doesn't want to talk about it.
Right.
So how do you heal? But you've been generous. You've come into a space of comedy that allows us to talk about this stuff. And you've been so open about it. In fact, you had a hashtag, Tell Your Story. Can you tell us about that?
Well, it was, I put out the song, which is so fun. It's called I Want to Kill My Rapist.
Oh, I know. I've got it here.
Yeah, I love it because I love that. I don't condone violence, but I think violence has a place in art where it's really cathartic. And so I wanted to talk about my experience. And so I was calling to people out in social media to share what they went through. And of course, now we have the same thing with the Me Too campaign, which
Absolutely.
Is great.
Absolutely.
So
Absolutely.
Great. Because it's like so many women. And you think, like, here are women, for the most part, the most powerful women in the world. If Angelina Jolie is afraid yep. to come forward, can you imagine how the rest of us feel? Like, it's really powerful. And so I'm humbled by all of these people who survived and are coming out and talking about it. Mm-hmm. Now it seems more important than ever for us to be talking about rape and talking about the rape culture. And not only like the sort of culture that condones rape, but the culture that condones silence about it. Mm-hmm. That's what most of it is. And that's why people are so, I think, nervous now, because that silence or the needing to keep those secrets, all of that is gone. And so that's
yes,
good.
Yes, yes. Now, you talked about the interesting response your mom had when you told her about what happened from the friend of the family to you.
Oh, well, she said, I know. They all know. I know that he's a rapist because he already raped your aunt, so you're not special.
You're not special.
That's like, I mean, it's really funny, but it's actually true. I mean, it's like that generation, her generation, they're just used to keeping those secrets, and because that's what they did.
Accepting that as part of the female responsibility, the female persona.
Yeah.
But in your song, you're encouraging women to get angry and yeah. do something.
Yeah.
You know, because we can be afraid and be silent, or we can get angry and let that fuel some action.
Yeah. I love that. Feminine rage can really fuel change. You see it all over the world. Like, I love that in France they're doing this about Roman Polanski. For some reason, France seems to think that they can hold a retrospective on this career lifetime rapist, a lifestyle rapist, and not just a rapist, but of young women, really young girls,
wow.
not women, young girls. And
wow.
so, you know, you're seeing these incredible, like, femme, like, people get really crazy when women use their anger to fuel them forward. They don't know what to do. It's so anarchic and so nuts, and I love it. So that's what's great that's happening all over the world.
I want to ask you a question. You have been very open about being bisexual. Why do you think society has such a hard time just accepting people?
Well, I think being gay is such a politicized identity that when you're gay, you got to be really, like, convinced that you're gay. Like, it's like you're like, I'm going to endure all of this societal hatred. I'm going to go against, quote unquote, against what society has planned for me, in that I'm going to go into a different life that makes sense to me. And so you have to commit so much to gayness in a very, very politicized way. Because when you're gay, oftentimes you're going to be called on to be in this army, you know, whether that's armies of gay pride or all of these army of lovers, this kind of lifestyle where you're going to listen to your own kind of music. You're going to dress your own kind of way. You're going to, like, go along with so much that, because I think the way that society is towards gay people and the homophobia that exists, we have to create our own society to step into. We can't sort of live in that other society anymore because it's too damaging
right.
and so depressing. So you circumvent the norm and you go into this other way. But if you're bisexual, you're sort of straddling those notions, like, okay, I'm here, but I'm also here. And so you don't feel fully embraced by gay culture, because the gay culture is like, you can't just go back. And then the straight culture is like, where are you going in the first place? So it's a very, like, politically, it's a very weird place to be in activism-wise. Like, where do I fit in this? It was better defined in the 90s when it was queer.
Okay.
But nowadays, focus has gone more towards gender fluidity as opposed to the identity politics of sexuality and who you sort of, like, want to be and who are you going to be in this community. And so I think in the 90s, we were so shell-shocked by AIDS that we were looking around sort of sex and looking for loopholes and trying to figure out how do we survive this plague and like going around and trying to figure it out. So it's a very special thing because that generation in the 90s, we were the ones that were just filled with fear around sexuality. And they were demanding that we find other avenues, whether that was BDSM or fetishism or body modification or piercing or like hanging from things. Like, it's very San Francisco.
Okay.
It's so that need to find transcendence that we would have normally found with sex in other avenues.
Okay.
So that's the culture I come from. So that makes it a little easier to sort of understand all of this sort of expanse of who we are and how our generation and the times inform our being.
So mentors. Tell me about Joan Rivers.
Well, Joan was really an interesting mentor because she was full of advice and full of kindness and warmth, but also full of fear. Like, she was a product of growing up female in the 50s, you know, and having that continual feeling of being passed over and not being the prettiest girl and not being the kind of like perfect wife and always having too big of a mouth and just being so crass and being considered crass. Like, I remember she was telling me, like, she was trying to do stand-up comedy on shows like Ed Sullivan, and she was, like, 7 months pregnant. And they're like, you can't do any jokes about being pregnant because that was considered incredibly crass at that time.
Oh, wow.
So she just had to kind of, like, not talk about it. You know, she's there with, like, maternity wear, but it's
wow.
like she can't even talk about it. So I just always loved listening to her talk about her kind of past and kind of coming into comedy, and she had so much faith in me.
Well, I remember you said in one of your interviews that Joan told you there was something in you that reminded her of herself.
Yes.
What was that?
I think she just said there was just like, oh, you're like the ugly girl. And I'm like, oh, my God. She's like, no, but you know what I mean. I go, no, I don't know what you mean.
Yeah.
But she's like, the one that laughs last. That was sort of her spin on it. It's like, you're the one that laughs last. Like, you just, you're going to get the last laugh no matter what. So I think that was more it, but it was so, so funny.
Well, when you talk about being funny, you know, if we were to listen to Christopher Hitchens, you can't be funny.
I know, but he's so dead. He's been dead for so long. Like, I mean, there's no part of him left on Earth. This has been long enough. I think, what did he die in, like, 2012
right,
or something?
Right. Oh, well, just 5 years.
Yeah, but that's enough time to be completely decomposed.
Erased. Yeah.
That's also, like, it's just a weird thing for people to imagine. Like, what do you mean, like, women can't be funny? Like, who are you talking to or who are you talking about? Like, all of my favorite comedians are women, even women from, like, a long time ago, whether that's Ruth Buzzy.
Right, right.
Or Rosemarie, who I love, and Lucille Ball, or any of these comedians, like Phyllis Diller.
Oh, yes.
Who's so great. And Joan, of course. Joan's my favorite, but there's just so many. And now contemporary women in comedy are incredibly diverse and so funny, like Tig Notaro, Wanda Sykes, Amy Schumer. In every sort of age group and kind of style, there's a great female comedian for that.
Why is comedy the such a good platform for protest?
I think because you're still an entertainer, but you also have that brief moment where you can make a point. Usually when people laugh, they're sort of recognizing something. And that laughter right. of recognition is kind of can also be looked at as agreement. Like, I'm going to laugh in agreement because I have to, and I can't control my reaction because laughter is involuntary often. So you got to go, oh, all right, I get you. I understand you. Even though I don't want to go there, I do. I get it. You know, so you have this like kind of reluctant agreement that, that's what comedy is, and so that's perfect for anything political because you can cajole or coerce an opinion that they weren't prepared to express.
So what's next for you?
I wrote a TV show with the amazing Liz Sarnoff. It's called Highland. It's about a Korean-American family, and it's about it's a new kind of Korean family that we've never seen before. They have an amazing marijuana business, which is, I think, the logical conclusion of, like, okay, if Koreans were going into liquor stores, then by rights, by that same kind of, like, thought process, they should be investing in marijuana businesses, which I think is really incredible. So it's called Highland. It's for TNT. Hopefully we'll see it soon. It's very exciting.
That was comedian, actor, and writer Margaret Cho. You've been listening to Common Space, a collaboration between First Person Arts and WHYY, and it's been supported by the Pew Center for Arts and Heritage. Check us out at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Our Common Space team includes executive producer and co-writer Elizabeth Perez Luna, producer Mike Villers, associate producers Ali L'Esperance and Jen Cleary, Tanisha Ford from First Person Arts, and archivist Dr. Neil Barden. Our engineer was Al Banks, and our theme music is by Subglow. I'm your host, producer, and co-writer, Jamie J. Thanks so much for listening.